They reached the next lodge late in the afternoon. It was a concrete pillbox surrounded by a high fence. Alexandra and Irina did the check this time, stepping on several small land scorpions. There was something lonely about the two women, stalking through knee-high vegetation. They both carried rifles, but used them only for poking among the leaves. Beyond the fence was the forest, darkening as daylight faded and denser clouds moved in. Ash took photos, as did Maggie. They went inside finally, and Boris did another search.
"My cans are in order," he announced, "and I have found no scorpions."
They unloaded the trucks and Alexandra made dinner. This time it was a pilaf and a mixture of spinach and chickpeas.
"Home food," said Arkady happily.
Heavy rain began to fall outside. Ash watched it through one of the virtual windows. It shone like a silver curtain in the lodge's spotlights. The low plants around the lodge bent under the weight of water, and a gusty wind made them flutter. Arkady got out plum brandy this time. Jason looked unhappy. Maggie recorded the lodge's interior, and Ash took shots of the Leica, head tilted and lenses shining in the false firelight. She had the impression that Maggie was perfectly content, in spite of the lack of drama.
"Want outside?" Baby said.
"The weather is bad," Ash replied. The pterosaur hunched down, looking as unhappy as Jason. Of course, the journalist wanted something exciting to happen. Ash was content to sit by the false fire and drink fruit brandy. What she liked about the outback was its strangeness, its inhumanity. Was that the right word? Being in a place without imported plants and animals, where people didn't fit in, though they had made roads, a few at least, and built lodges. Maybe what she liked about Arkady was his line of work. This was his turf. As much as anyone, he knew Aphrodite Terra. In some ways, Venus was lucky. Earth did not have the resources to really settle the planet. The USSR had destroyed itself trying to win the Venus race. The US had largely given up, in part because it no longer had a rival, and in part because the problems on Earth kept getting worse. Venus provided some raw materials, not many, the shipping costs were ridiculous, and it was a tourist destination. Some people retired to the gated communities near Venusport. Others bought beachside condos against the time that Earth was no longer habitable. But most of the planet remained empty of humanity. The next day they moved on. The ground was rising and getting stonier, and the trees were all short, with big drooping leaves. Small animals moved in the branches and the undergrowth. Midway through the afternoon, their truck turned off the rutted track into forest, mashing low plants and avoiding trees. The second truck followed.
"What?" asked Ash.
"We are going to show National Geographic a good time," Arkady said, "as you asked us to."
"And make a point," Boris added.
"Do you mind telling me what?" Ash asked.
"In good time," Arkady replied. "I'm tired of Jason's complaining about our fauna. It reminds me of other safaris I have led, full of rich tourists who want dinosaurs. I tell them that Venusian fauna is similar to fauna on Earth, but not identical, and we are not in the Jurassic. I've had the bastards ask for money back because we couldn't show them an Allosaurus. I wanted to feed them to a pseudosuchus, which might not impress them, but could certainly eat them."
Arkady was usually even-tempered, but he sounded angry now. Well, she got angry at some of her work. The fashion shoots could be fairly awful. They crunched through more undergrowth. There were rocks here, making the driving chancy. Outcroppings of a creamy yellow stone.
"Limestone," Arkady said. "This used to be underwater. They ought to be good fossils, though Jason does not strike me as a fossil man.
I'm not one, Boris said, guiding the truck between two good-sized chunks of stone. A pair of pterosaurs rested on top of one. They were big, with impressive crests.
Stop, said Ash.
Boris did. She photographed the animals, which looked damn fine, their crests like orange sails.
Don't like,
Baby muttered. Of course not. These guys were big enough to eat him. They would if given the chance. The pterosaurs were not cannibals, but they happily ate related species, as humans once ate monkeys when there were monkeys in the wild. They went on, coming finally to another track, this one much less used than the one they had been following. Boris turned onto it.
I don't remember this, Ash said.
It's good country, Arkady said. Interesting, but the damn gutless executive committee has decided the area is off limits.
Are you breaking rules? Ash asked.
Yes, this is the perfect time to explore with a National Geographic videographer along. And with the CIA putting poisonous spies in our lodge, Boris growled.
Ash had a bad feeling, but Arkady ran the most reputable tours on the continent. They bumped among more outcropping of cream-yellow rock.
This looks right, Boris said, glancing at his GPS, which was in Cyrillic.
Ash could not read it.
For what? She asked.
An impact crater, said Arkady, or something else.
Boris hit the brakes. Next to the road was a low wall made of yellow limestone. It curved gently, apparently part of a huge circle. The section in front of them had been dug out. Heaps of dirt lay in front of it. Off to either side, the soil had not been excavated, and the wall was a mound covered with low plants and vines.
I wasn't expecting the excavation, Arkady said. I suppose we have the CIA to thank.
Who built this? Ash asked.
Not us, Arkady replied, and not the CIA. It shows up in early satellite surveys, along with three other circles, all in this area and all arranged in a broad arc. One circle is broken, only half there. The rest are complete. None has been investigated. In theory, they are impact craters from a body that broke apart before it hit. Remember that our colony was run from Earth. The apparatchiks in Moscow said exploration could wait. This wasn't a scientific settlement. It was military and economic. By the time we were ready to look around, the CIA was in the area. The government decided to leave them alone. We didn't have the power to confront the Americans.
They all climbed out and walked to the wall. It looked to be made of the same stone as the outcroppings, but it was a single piece, as far as Ash could tell, and the surface was slick. Ash ran her hand along it, as smooth as glass. When she pulled her hand away, she saw blood. The edge of the wall was knife sharp.
Here, said Arkady, and handed her a red handkerchief.
What's that for? Ash asked. The revolution?
At the moment, it's for your hand. Use it.
Ash wrapped the handkerchief around the bleeding fingers. Maggie was recording her, she noticed. The wall, the part above ground at least, was more than a meter high, too tall to sit on comfortably if one was human, and too tall to step over comfortably.
Amazing, Jason said. If humans did not build this, then it is proof of intelligent life on Venus.
There isn't any, Ash put in. The brightest things on the planet are animals like Baby. He's bright, but he doesn't build walls.
It can't possibly be natural, Jason said.
I agree, Arkady replied. I also agree with Ash. I do not think this was built by anything native to Venus.
Maggie was panning, making a record of the entire length of the wall. In back of them, a voice asked,
"Who the hell are you?"
Ash turned, as did the others. A soldier in full body armor stood in the road between the two trucks. He was carrying a terrifying-looking, very high-tech rifle. Ash saw that first. Then she noticed that he was standing above the road, his boots not touching the surface.
"You are a hologram," Boris said.
"Yes, but there are gun emplacements all around you. Take a look."
Ash did. Red lights, sighting lasers, shone on top of neighboring rocks. As far as she could tell, they were aimed at her.
"If you doubt me, I can melt something," the hologram said. "You're a robot."
"She's autonomous," Jason replied quickly. "A citizen of the United States and an employee of National Geographic."
"Shit," said the hologram. "Stay put. I have to consult. If you move, the guns will fire."
The soldier vanished. "Are you still recording?" Jason asked Maggie.
"Yes, and I'm uploading my images to the nearest comsat. This place is about to become famous."
"That will make life uncomfortable for the CIA, said Arcady in a tone of satisfaction. "And the useless Petrograd Executive Committee," Boris added.
"And for us," Ash put in. "You have just pissed off the most dangerous organization in the solar system." The hologram reappeared.
"I have backup coming. Stay where you are. I've been informed that your robot is emitting radio signals. Stop that."
"Very well," Maggie said. She didn't add that it was too late.
They waited, staying where they were, even though a fine rain began to fall. Inside the truck cab, Baby squawked for food.
"Later," Ash called. "Hungry?"
At last, a car appeared, bumping down the track. It stopped, and a pair of men climbed out, dressed entirely in black, with shiny black boots. They wore computer glasses with opaque lenses and dark, thick frames.
"Who are you?"
one asked.
"Arkady Volkov, Wildlife Tours," Arkady said.
"National Geographic," Jason added.
"Ashley Weatherman, Fashion Art," Ash put in.
"Shit,"
the man said, then added,
"Follow us and don't try anything funny. There are guns in the forest. Any trouble and they will melt your trucks."
They climbed into the trucks. Arkady handed Ash a first aid kit and she sprayed a bandage on her fingers. The antiseptic in it made the cut sting. Venusian microbes did not usually infect humans, but there were Earth microbes spreading across the planet, and some of them were nasty. The car turned and went back the way it had come. The trucks followed. As they began to move, Ash looked back. The hologram soldier was still in the middle of the road, rifle in hand, watching. Then the second truck rolled through him, and he was gone.
"I apologize," Arkady said. "I thought we could look at one crater and get out safely, with a few images that might, I hoped, endanger the CIA's control of this region."
"Were you expecting to find an alien artifact?" Ash asked.
"The longer we looked at the craters, the more suspicious they have looked," Boris said. "We were looking at the CIA, of course. We would not have examined the satellite images so closely otherwise."
Ash leaned back and drank more tea. Next to her, Baby gnawed on a chow stick. Of course she was worried, but she couldn't imagine the CIA taking out National Geographic. Even monsters had their limits. The rain grew heavier. Looking out, Ash saw a group of fire scorpions resting on a tree trunk, sheltered by foliage. They weren't large, but their exoskeletons were bright red. A warning of serious poison.
"I don't think I will draw Maggie's attention to them," Arkady said. The CIA might not want us on the radio.
A pity. They look handsome, and they are very poisonous. Tourists always enjoy deadly animals.
A half hour later, they reached a cliff made of the same yellow stone as the outcroppings. It rose above the forest, running as far as she could see in both directions. The road ended in front of it. The car stopped, and they stopped as well. Everyone climbed down.
Leave the rifles in the trucks, one of the men said, and you can leave that thing too.
He waved at Baby in his cage. He gets lonely, Ash said. One man went ahead of them, opening a door in the cliff face. It looked human-made, but Ash was less sure of the opening it closed. Rectangular, very tall and narrow, it didn't look like the kind of doorway humans would cut. They filed through, followed by the second man who closed the door and locked it. Inside was a corridor, as tall and narrow and rectangular as the opening. Lights were stuck along the walls. These were clearly human. As for the corridor itself, the stone was polished and as slick as glass. There were fossils in it. Ash made out shells, gleaming behind the glossy surface, as well as long things that might be worms or crinoids, though this world did not have crinoids. If she'd had another life to live, she would have been a biologist or paleontologist, though she had a low tolerance for the finicky work required of both. Maybe it was a better idea to shoot fashion models and megafauna. Baby muttered in his cage. The corridor ended in another narrow doorway, this one without a door. Beyond it was a rectangular room with polished stone walls. Like the hall, it was narrow and tall. It contained a table and chairs, all 3D printed. Ash recognized the style. Human office modern.
Okay, said one of the men. He took off his glasses, showing pale blue eyes with dark puffy skin below them. What is this about? We have a deal with the executive committee of the Petrograd Soviet.
He looked at the other man, who still wore glasses.
Mike, get coffee, will you?
Sure, Mike answered. Don't say anything exciting till I get back.
The voice was contralto. Ash took another look. Mike was either a woman or an FTM, though it was well hidden by the boxy suit and heavy-rimmed computer glasses. Not that it mattered. A female CIA agent was as dangerous as a male. Mike left, and they sat down. Arkady and Boris looked grim. Irina and Alexandra looked worried. The Nat Geo journalist had an expression that combined fear and excitement. Maggie's gleaming lens face revealed nothing.
Who built this? Arkady asked. We don't know, the man replied. We found it. Are there artifacts? Arkady asked. Aside from the circles and these tunnels, nothing we have found.
This is a site of system-wide historical importance, Boris said. Evidence that someone not human was on Venus before we came. You sat in it, keeping the people of Petrograd and the scientists on Venus and Earth from investigating, not to mention the tourists we could have brought in, improving our economy.
It meant we didn't have to set up camp in the forest, the man said. It's dry in here, and there's a lot less animal life, or was, till recently. Believe me, this place isn't interesting. Just corridors and rooms going a long way back into the cliff. All empty except for the debris left by animals, bones and dry leaves and dried out feces.
Mike came back with a tray, carafe, and coffee cups. He, or she, poured coffee. There was a slight chill in the room, and it was pleasant to hold the warm cup and sip the hot coffee. Ash's cut fingers still stung a little.
The question is, what will we do with you?
the first man said. National Geographic will be concerned if we vanish, Jason said. He sounded anxious.
Accidents happen in the outback, Mike said in his or her high voice.
I was recording and uploading my images until your hologram told me to stop, Maggie put in. The material went to the nearest Comsat, which belongs, I believe, to Petrograd. I assume the Comsat sent it on to our office in Venusport. The message was encrypted to prevent piracy, but our office can decode it. They will have done so by now.
They know about the circle, Jason added, and the robot you put in the lodge.
What robot?
The man asked.
The bug, the scorpion. It had wires.
Mike was leaning against a wall, cup in hand. The nameless man looked over, frowning.
Not ours, Mike said. Petrograd must be spying on itself.
Baby stirred in his cage. Ash reached a finger to scratch him and, in the same movement, undid the lock on the door. No one seemed to notice except Baby, who looked interested and alert. She wondered about ventilation and ways to escape, looked around and saw a rectangle cut in the stone of one wall just below the ceiling. It was long and narrow, with vertical bars made of the same stone as the wall. As she watched, a pair of antennae poked out between two of the bars. The animal followed. A scorpion, of course. The pale grey body suggested it was a cave scorpion, as did the lack of obvious eyes. She watched as its front legs scrabbled to get a grip on the slick stone. It failed and fell, landing with an audible tock. The nameless man spun in his chair, then was up and stamping the scorpion over and over. It wasn't even that big, Ash thought, no more than 20 centimeters. The man remained bent over for several moments.
Oh, God, I hate them!
They are carrion eaters, Arcady said, living off the debris of pterosaur colonies that nest on cliffs and in shallow caves. Their bite does little harm to humans.
I hate them, the man repeated.
He has a phobia, Mike said. Cave scorpions don't bother me.
The nameless agent straightened up.
The tunnels connect with caves. The damn things have discovered they can live off us. They're all over.
But hardly a serious problem, Arcady said.
We also have fire scorpions, Mike put in.
The nameless agent twitched at the name. Mike smiled slightly. Ash had the impression he enjoyed his colleague's fear.
That is a problem, Boris said. But you shouldn't have them. They live in the forest, not in caves.
They've bred with the cave scorpions, the nameless man said.
His voice sounded constricted, as if fear had robbed him of breath.
They can't have, Arcady said. They are different species, living in different environments.
The two men exchanged glances and were silent. After a moment, Boris said harshly,
You are not satisfied with robot scorpions. You have played with DNA and created a new species in violation of numerous laws.
Not the laws on Earth, Mike said.
You are on Venus, Boris pointed out, and in Petrograd.
I don't think we need to talk about this.
Yes, we do, Arcady replied. And not just here. You are in very serious violation of several treaties. Venus and Earth need to know about this.
The nameless agent pulled out a handgun, aiming it at Arcady. The gun was shaking. Ash could see that clearly. The gun, the shaking hand, the room, the other people were all unnaturally sharp and clear.
Go, she said to Baby. The pterosaur was out in a moment, flapping onto the agent's head and clawing.
The gun went off with a loud, very loud sound. Arkady dove at the man, taking him down. The gun spun across the floor, away from Arkady and the nameless agent.
"Stop that," Mike said.
Ash looked toward him. His coffee cup lay on the yellow floor, in the middle of a brown pool of coffee, and he had a gun out, pointing it at Arkady. Never mix with the CIA, but it was too late for that warning.
"No,"
said Alexandra. Ash was trying not to move, but she could see the ex-cop from the corner of her eye. The woman had a gun, held steadily, and pointed at Mike. This was ridiculous.
"Get the damn animal off Brian,"
Mike said. The nameless agent was on the floor, Arkady lying across him, and Baby still on his head, biting and clawing.
"Stop," Ash called. "You can stop now, Baby."
The pterosaur flapped back to his cage, settling on top and folding his downy wings.
"This is stupid," Mike said. "I'm not going to shoot anyone in here, and I hope to God this lovely lady is not going to shoot me. You guys look like idiots on the floor. Get up."
The two men did. Arkady looked rumpled, which was his usual condition. Blood ran down the face of the nameless agent. He wiped it with one hand, making a smear.
"We're pulling out," Mike added. "Petrograd knows this."
"Why?" asked Boris.
"Why do they know? We told them. Why are you pulling out?"
"The scorpions. The things are deadly. And Brian's right. They're all over."
"Am I right?" Boris said. "Did you create them?"
Mike was silent.
"They must have wanted something that could live in sewers and the crawl spaces of buildings," Arkady put in. "And that was toxic. It sounds like a weapon that could be used against Petrograd."
"They are telling us too much," Boris said. "They must be planning to kill us."
"Not while I hold this gun," Alexandra said.
"We're pulling out, as I told you," Mike said, "and there is no proof that we made the scorpions or intended to use them for anything. You Soviets are way too paranoid."
"How many people are left here?" Arkady asked.
"Dozens," said the agent named Brian.
"Don't be a fool. We saw no one coming in, and no one has responded to the sound of gunfire. Either you are alone, or your colleagues are not close."
"Three," Mike answered. "They're in the back rooms destroying the equipment. When they're done, we'll take the last VTL.
Boris pulled a roll of duct tape from his vest. He tossed it to Arkady.
"Tape them up."
"No," said Brian. "What if more scorpions come?"
"Too bad," Boris said.
The man bolted for the room's doorway. Baby flapped onto him, clawing and shrieking, "Bad, bad." Brian stumbled. Box-like Irina grabbed his arm and pulled him around, then drove a fist into the man's midsection. He bent over, coughing, and collapsed onto his knees. Fortunately, because Ash hated vomit, he did not throw up.
"That's some punch," Mike said in his or her pleasant voice.
"She used to be a stevedore," Arkady said. "Now I will tape you up, and you will hope that none of your new mutant scorpions arrive."
"I'm not phobic," Mike replied, "and I'm not going to shoot it out with you. We don't know what these walls are made of, but you can't scratch them. Anything that hits them is going to bounce off."
He put his gun on the table. "We've been lucky so far. The last ricochet didn't hit anyone. I think the bullet went out the door. There's no reason to think we'll be lucky a second time."
Arkady and Irina taped the two men while Alexandra kept her gun leveled.
"Are you recording?"
Arkady asked after they were done.
"Yes," Maggie said, "but I'm having trouble with my radio signal here. As soon as we are outside, I will send the photos to Venusport."
Arkady set a knife on the table next to Mike's gun.
It will cut the tape, he said to Mike. Even if your comrades don't come looking for you, you'll be able to get free.
That may be a mistake, Boris said.
Arkady nodded.
We all make them. Let's get out of here.
They left the room and retraced their way through the maze-like stone corridors. No one appeared, though they did encounter a scorpion crawling over the floor. It was dirty pink with tiny eyes, 30 centimeters long, and the ugliest land scorpion Ash had ever seen. Boris stepped on it hard, crushing its exoskeleton. The many legs kept scrabbling and the mandibles twitched back and forth, but the animal's body could not move. It was broken.
This is why we wear tall boots, he said.
They found the trucks where they had left them. Rain still fell heavily.
I can send the recordings now, Maggie said.
Do it, Jason said. I'm going to write an exposé that will rip those guys apart. They were ready to kill us. They ran for the trucks, climbed in, and pulled out, going along the track away from the ruins. Ash could feel her heart beating rapidly. Her mouth was dry and she was shaking. Fear fighting with amazement. She had been inside ruins built by aliens, and she had escaped from the CIA. What a day. Baby was in his cage, shivering and repeating, "Bad, bad," over and over in a quiet voice.
Okay, Ash said after her heart slowed down. What was that about?
Arkady leaned forward and checked the truck radio, which was off.
We knew the CIA was here and that they had some kind of agreement with the Petrograd Executive Committee. We knew about the circles, and we had this.
He handed her a tablet. On the screen was a piece of sculpture, deeply worn and barely recognizable as a person. It had two arms and two legs, all long and thin, the legs together and the arms folded across the chest. The person's torso was short and wide, its neck long and narrow, its head wedge-shaped.
This might be expressive distortion, Arkady said, or it might be an alien. It is only 10 centimeters long. It was found in the outback in the early days of settlement, and it ended in the Petrograd Museum. The curators thought it was fake. It remained in the collection, but was never investigated. We learned about it and put it together with the circles, Boris said. Do you have any idea how much money Petrograd could make from tourism if we had authentic alien ruins?
Who are you? Ash asked.
People who want to embarrass the executive committee, Arkady said. Can you imagine what Lenin would have said about that collection of petty bureaucrats? Now National Geographic will publish its exclusive. With luck, there will be a huge stink. The Petrograd Soviet will decide to remove the executive committee, and the CIA will be so embarrassed that it will leave Aphrodite Terra. That's too much to hope, Boris growled.
Maybe, Arkady replied.
In any case, we couldn't pass up the chance. The entire solar system pays attention to the National Geographic.
What about the bug in the lodge? Ash asked. Mike said it wasn't one of theirs.
It was CIA, but they didn't put it in the lodge. Some of our farm workers found it crawling in the fields, heading toward Petrograd, and sent for the police. They captured it. I brought it with us, Boris said. We wanted Nat Geo to see what we had to put up with. Poisonous robot spies. They are a crime against nature and peaceful coexistence.
The truck was bumping over the rough road, among dripping trees, while rain beat on the windows. Looking back, she saw the other truck, dim in the rain. I feel as if everything has been fake,
she told the two men. You set up the robot Scorpion, and you set up discovering the circle. Arkady said,
The circles are real, and they are not impact craters, though we don't know what they are. Ball courts, fish ponds, temples. And the tunnels are real. We didn't know about them, but now they will be famous.
Boris added,
Those idiots on the executive committee were so afraid that they let the CIA camp on a site of system-wide historical importance. We have been slowly dying when we could have made a fortune from tourism. Why would anyone go to Venusport when they can come here and see alien ruins?
He was silent for a moment, then added,
We'll have to get rid of their damn pink scorpions. That won't be easy. And then take a serious look. Who knows what may be in the caves and circles? More statues like the one in the museum? Maybe even a skeleton?
Who are you guys? Ash asked.
Arkady laughed. I am myself, Arkady Volkov of Volkov Tours. Boris is a part-time employee.
What else does he do?
I'm an analyst for the political police, Boris replied. But my hours have been cut because of the Soviets' cash flow problems, which we would not have if we had more tourists. Or if the executive committee stopped listening to American economists, Arkady added. I don't want a lecture on economics, Boris said. I needed a second job. Arkady gave me one.
And Irina and Alexandra? Ash asked.
Ordinary working people, Arkady said.
Could the CIA really have been stupid enough to create a new kind of scorpion? Ash asked.
Remember that no one has ever gone broke by underestimating the intelligence of Americans, Arkady said.
This seems way too Byzantine, Ash added. Boris gave a rasping laugh.
Arkady's ancestors came from some damn place in Central Asia, but I am Russian, and Russians are the heirs of Byzantium.
They made it back to the pillbox lodge at nightfall. Arkady and Boris checked the parking space with flashlights and called all clear. They went in through the rain. Arkady turned on the fire as the rest of them pulled off their wet jackets and hung them up to dry.
I'll start dinner, Alexandra told them. Irina, will you help?
The ex-cop and the ex-stevedore went into the kitchen. Ash sat down in front of the fire, baby's cage on the floor next to her. Baby climbed on top of the cage.
Hungry?
She found a piece of chow and gave it to him.
Hunt,
he said. Not now. Jason and Maggie joined her, the journalist settling into a chair, the Leica standing on her four silver legs, her long neck stretched out, head turning as she made another recording.
I think we can call the trip successful, Jason said. We have discovered the first evidence of intelligent aliens, and I have a dramatic story about fighting the CIA.
I suspect the CIA part of the story will vanish, Arkady said. But you will have the alien ruins.
I'll fight for the entire story, Jason said. It's outrageous that we were threatened by our own government.
We'll go back to Petrograd, Arkady said. I will show you a piece of sculpture at the museum, and you might be interested in talking to the Soviet's executive committee. Ask them what they were thinking to let the CIA perch in the most important piece of archaeology in the solar system. God knows what kind of damage they might have done. War, overt or covert, is not good for art or history.
Boris set a bottle of fruit brandy on the table, along with four glasses.
I'll go back. I have worked as an exterminator. I want to know what's in the tunnels and the caves aside from vermin, and I will enjoy getting rid of those damn pink scorpions.
After dinner in her bedroom, Ash considered the journey. She was a little buzzed from alcohol and shaky from adrenaline, but nothing was happening now. She could finally think. The circles and tunnels could not have been faked. She was less certain about the figurine. It didn't have the glassy surface of the stone in the circle and the tunnels, and even if the government in Moscow hadn't been interested in science, it would have been interested in an alien figurine. That had to have some kind of propaganda value, unless they were afraid of it. Would fear have made them put it in a museum and forget it? It would be easy to fake something as small as the figurine. Arkady said it was in the Petrograd Museum, but he could have brought it with him, planning to plant it near the circle for Jason to find. That and the toxic scorpion in the lodge would have given National Geographic its big story. With luck, the story would have forced the CIA out and brought down the executive committee. She could imagine Arkady learning who the client was and hurriedly putting together an elaborate con. Never trust a Leninist entirely. And she could imagine him as completely honest. As far as she knew, he always had been. Well, if the figurine was fake, that would be discovered, probably quickly. But the ruins had to be real. She lay there, her light still on, considering the possibility that humanity was not alone. Where were the aliens now? In the solar system? Or had they moved on? And what difference would knowledge of them make to Earth, shambling toward destruction? Or to Venus, tied to Earth and maybe unable to survive on its own? Ash had no idea. But the world, the two worlds, had suddenly become more interesting and full of possibility.
"Turn light off,"
said Baby, hunched in his cage.
"Sleep."
The end. Note: our Venus rotates backward compared to most planets in the solar system, and its day is longer than its year. The current theory is that it was dinged by something big early in the development of the system. The ding turned it backward and slowed its rotation. In my alternative history, this ding did not happen. My Venus rotates forward and has a day about as long as that of Earth or Mars. This rotation gives it a magnetic field, which our Venus does not have. The field prevents, at least in part, the development of the planet's current toxic greenhouse atmosphere. In addition, there was a ding that didn't happen in our history, at least as far as we know. A body, possibly two, hit Earth after life had developed there, then went on to hit Venus, depositing Earth microbes. As a result, my Venus has blue-green algae, and this, over time, gave it an atmosphere comparable to Earth. The similarity of Venusian life to life on Earth is due to the shared genetic history. The history of Earth is the same as in our timeline, until Soviet probes discover that Venus is habitable. Then a serious space race begins. The cost of the race helps to destroy the Soviet Union and helps to distract the United States from dealing with global warming. As you may have noticed, the Pechenek machine gun was never used. Chekhov was wrong. You can put a gun on the wall in the first act and never use it.
David Brin. Change may not be good, but it's often unavoidable, especially when it's your whole world that's about to change. David Brin entered the science fiction field in the late 1970s and has been one of the most prominent SF writers in the business ever since, winning 3 Hugo Awards and 1 Nebula Award for his work. Brin is best known for his Uplift series, which started in 1980 with Sundiver and subsequently has continued in Startide Rising, which won both a Hugo in 1984 and a Nebula in 1983, The Uplift War, which won a Hugo in 1988, and then on through Brightness Reef, Infinity's Shore, Heaven's Reach, and Gorilla My Dreams. There's also a guide to the Uplift Universe, Contacting Aliens, an illustrated guide to David Brin's Uplift Universe by Brin and Kevin Lana. He won another Hugo Award in 1985 for his short story, The Crystal Spheres, and won the John W. Campbell Memorial Award in 1986 for his novel, The Postman, which was later made into a big-budget film starring Kevin Costner. Brin's other novels include Kiln People, Kiln Time, The Practice Effect, Earth, Glory Season, Sky Horizon, and, with Gregory Benford, Heart of the Comet. His short work has been collected in The River of Time, Otherness, and Tomorrow Happens. He edited the anthology Project Solar Sail with Arthur C. Clarke and has published several nonfiction books such as The Transparent Society, Through Stranger Eyes, and King Kong is Back, an unauthorized look at one humongous ape. His most recent book is a new novel, Existence.
The Tumbledowns of Cleopatra Abyss by David Brin. Read for you by Will Wheaton. 1. Today's thump was overdue. Jonah wondered if it might not come at all. Just like last Thor Day, when, at the old clock's mid-morning chime, farmers all across the bubble habitat clambered up pinion vines or crouched low in expectation of the regular daily throb, a pulse and quake that hammered up your footsoles and made all the bubble boundaries shake. Only Thorday's thump never came. The chime was followed by silence and a creepy letdown feeling, and Jonah's mother lit a candle, hoping to avert bad luck. Early last spring, there had been almost a whole week without any thumps. 5 days in a row, with no rain of detritus shaken loose from the upper world, tumbling down here to the ocean bottom, and 2 smaller gaps the previous year. Apparently, today would be yet another hiatus. Whomp! Delayed, the thump came hard, shaking the moist ground beneath Jonah's feet. He glanced with concern toward the bubble boundary more than 200 meters away, a membrane of ancient translucent volcanic stone separating the Paddy's and Pinion Forest from black, crushing waters just outside. The barrier vibrated, an unpleasant scraping sound. This time, especially, it caused Jonah's teeth to grind. They used to sing, you know, commented the complacent old woman who worked at a nearby freeboard loom, nodding as gnarled fingers darted among the strands, weaving ropey cloth. Her hands did not shake, though the nearby grove of thick vines did, quivering much worse than after any normal thump. I'm sorry, grandmother. Jonah reached out to a nearby bowl of twisted cables that dangled from the bubble habitat's high-arching roof, where shining glow leaves provided the settlement's light. Who used to sing? The walls, silly boy. The bubble walls. Thumps used to come exactly on time, according to the old clock. Though every year we would shorten the main wheel by the same amount, taking 13 seconds off the length of a day. Aftershakes always arrived from the same direction. You could depend on it. And the bubble sang to us. It sang? You mean like that awful groan? Jonah poked a finger in one ear as if to pry out the fading reverberation. He peered into the nearby forest of thick trunks and vines, listening for signs of breakage, of disaster. Not at all. It was musical, comforting, especially after a miscarriage. Back then, a woman would lose over half of her quickenings. Not like today when more babies are born alive than warped or misshapen or dead. Your generation has it lucky. And it said things were even worse in olden days. The founders were fortunate to get any living replacements at all. Several times our population dropped dangerously. She shook her head, then smiled. Oh, but the music. After every mid-morning thump, you could face the bubble walls and relish it. That music helped us women bear our heavy burden. Yes, grandmother, I'm sure it was lovely, Jonah replied, keeping a respectful voice as he tugged on the nearest pinion to test its strength, then clambered upward, hooking long, unwebbed toes into the braided vines, rising high enough to look around. None of the other men or boys could climb as well. Several nearby bulls appeared to have torn loose their mooring suckers from the dome-like roof. Six of them teetered, lost their final grip holds, then tumbled, their luminous tops crashing into the rice lagoon, setting off eruptions of sparks, or else onto the worksheds where Panelina and her mechanics could be heard shouting in dismay. It's a bad one, Jonah thought. Already the hab bubble seemed dimmer. If many more pinions fell, the clan might dwell in semi-darkness or even go hungry. Oh, it was beautiful, all right, the old woman continued, blithely ignoring any ruckus. Of course, in my grandmother's day, the thumps weren't just regular and perfectly timed. They came in pairs. And it is said that long before, in her grandmother's grandmother's time, when a day lasted so long that it spanned several sleep periods, thumps used to arrive in clusters of four or five. How things must have shook back then. But always from the same direction and exactly at the mid-morning chime. She sighed, implying that Jonah and all the younger folk were making too much fuss. You call this a thump shock? Of course, she admitted, the bubbles were younger then. More flexible, I suppose. Eventually, some misplaced thump is going to end us all. Jonah took a chance. He was in enough trouble already without offending the oldest female, who had undergone 34 pregnancies and still had 6 living womb fruit, 4 of them precious females. But grandmother seemed in a good mood, distracted by memories. Jonah took off, clambering higher till he could reach with his left hand for one of the independent dangle vines that sometimes laced the gaps between pinions. With his right hand, he flicked with his belt knife, severing the dangler a meter or so below his knees. Sheathing the blade and taking a deep breath, he launched off, swinging across an open space in the forest, and finally alighting along a second giant bole. It shook from his impact, and Jonah worried. If this one was weakened and I'm the reason that it falls, I could be in for real punishment, not just grandma tending duty. A rascal's reputation might have been harmless when Jonah was younger, but now the mothers were pondering what Tyree Dome might have to pay in dowry for some other bubble colony to take him. A boy known to be unruly might not get any offers at any marriage price, and a man without a wife sponsor led a marginal existence. But honestly, this last time wasn't my fault. How am I supposed to make an improved pump without filling something with high-pressure water? All right, the kitchen rice cooker was a poor choice, but it has a gauge in everything. Or it used to. After quivering far too long, the great vine held. With a brief sense of relief, he scrambled around to the other side. There was no convenient dangler this time, but another pinion towered fairly close. Jonah flexed his legs, prepared and launched himself across the gap, hurtling with open arms, alighting with shock and painful clumsiness. He didn't wait, though, scurrying to the other side, where there was another dangle vine, well-positioned for a wide-spanning swing. This time, he couldn't help himself while hurtling across open space, giving vent to a yell of exhilaration. 2 swings and 4 leaps later, he was right next to the bubble's edge, reaching out to stroke the nearest patch of ancient, vitrified stone in a place where no one would see him break taboo. Pushing at the transparent barrier, Jonah felt deep ocean pressure shoving back. The texture felt rough-ribbed, uneven. Sliver flakes rubbed off, dusting his hand. Of course, bubbles were younger then, the old woman said. More flexible. Jonah had to wrap a length of danglevine around his left wrist and clutch the pinion with his toes in order to lean far out and bring his face right up against the bubble. It sucked heat into bottomless cold. Using his right hand and arm to cup around his face and peer into the blackness outside. Adapting vision gradually revealed the stony walls of Cleopatra Canyon, the narrow, deep canyon where humanity had come to take shelter so very long ago, fleeing the Koss invaders before the lifespans of many grandmothers. Several strings of globe-like habitats lay parallel along the canyon bottom, like pearls on a necklace, each of them surrounded by a froth of smaller bubbles, though fewer of the little ones than there were in olden times, and none any more in the most useful sizes. It was said that, way back at the time of the founding, there used to be faint illumination overhead, filtering downward from the surface and demarking night from day. Light that came from the mythological god thing that old books called the sun, so fierce that it could penetrate both dense, poisonous clouds and the ever-growing ocean. But that was way back in a long-ago past, when the sea had not yet burgeoned so, filling canyons, becoming a dark and mighty deep. Now the only gifts that fell from above were clots of detritus that men gathered to feed algae ponds, debris that got stranger every year. These days the canyon walls could only be seen by light from the bubbles themselves, by their pinion glow within. Jonah turned slowly left to right, counting and naming those farm enclaves he could see. Amtor, Leininger, Chown, Cutnor, Okumo. Each one a clan with traditions and styles all their own. Each one possibly the place where Tyree tribe might sell him in a marriage pact. A mere boy in good riddance. Good at numbers and letters, a bit skilled with his hands, but notoriously absent-minded. Prone to staring at nothing and occasionally putting action to rascally thoughts. He kept tallying. Brackett, Lewis, Atari, Napier, Aldrin. What? Jonah blinked. What was happening to Aldrin? And the bubble just beyond it? Both Aldrin and Bezo were still quivering. He could make out few details at this range through the milky pitted membrane, but one of the two was rippling and convulsing, the glimmer of its pinion forest shaking back and forth as the giant bowls swayed, then collapsed. The other distant habitat seemed to be inflating, or so Jonah thought at first. Rubbing his eyes and pressing even closer as Bezo habitat grew bigger, or else it was rising. Jonah could not believe what he saw. Torn loose somehow from the ocean floor, the entire bubble was moving upward. And as Bezo ascended, its flattened bottom now reshaped itself as farms and homes and lagoons tumbled together into the base of the accelerating globe. With its pinions still mostly in place, Bezo colony continued glowing as it climbed upward. Aghast, and yet compelled to look, Jonah watched until the glimmer that had been Bezo finally vanished in blackness, accelerating toward the poisoned surface of Venus. Then, without warning or mercy, Habitat Aldrin imploded. 2. I was born in Bezo, you know. Jonah turned to see Enoch leaning on his rake, staring south along the canyon wall, toward a gaping crater where that ill-fated settlement bubble used to squat. Distant glimmers of glow lamps flickered over there as crews prowled along the Aldrin debris field, sifting for salvage. But that was a job for mechanics and senior workers. Meanwhile, the algae ponds and pinions must be fed, so Jonah also found himself outside, in coveralls that stank and fogged from his own breath and many generations of previous wearers, helping to gather the week's harvest of organic detritus. Jonah responded in the same dialect Enoch had used. Click-tock. The only way to converse when both of you are deep underwater. Come on, he urged his older friend, a recent marriage price immigrant to Tyree Bubble. All of that is behind you. A male should never look back. We do as we are told. Enoch shrugged, broad shoulders making his stiff coveralls scrunch around the helmet, fashioned from an old foam bubble of a size no longer found in these parts. Enoch's phlegmatic resignation was an adaptive skill that served him well, as he was married to Jonah's cousin, Jezzy, an especially strong-willed young woman, bent on exerting authority and not above threatening her new husband with casting out. I can hope for someone gentle when I'm sent to live beside a stranger in a strange dome. Jonah resumed raking up newly fallen organic stuff, mostly ropey bits of vegetation that lay limp and pressure-crushed after their long tumble to the bottom. In recent decades, there had also been detritus of another kind. Shells that had holes in them for legs and heads, and skeleton fragments from slinky creatures that must have, when living, stretched as long as Jonah was tall. Much more complicated than the mudworms that kept burrowing closer to the domes of late. More like the fabled snakes or fish that featured in tales from old Earth. Panalina's dad, old scholar Wu, kept a collection of skyfalls in the little museum by Tyree's Eastern Arc, neatly labeled specimens dating back at least 10 grandmother cycles to the era when light and heat still came down along with debris from above, a claim that Jonah still deemed mystical. Perhaps just a legend, like old Earth. These samples. Do you see how they are getting more complicated, Jonah? So explained Old Man Wu as he traced patterns of veins in a recently gathered seaweed. And do you make out what's embedded here? Bits of creatures living on or within the plant. And there, does that resemble a bite mark? The outlines of where teeth tore into this vegetation? Could that act of devouring be what sent it tumbling down to us? Jonah pondered what it all might mean while raking up dross and piling it onto the sledge, still imagining the size of a jaw that could have torn such a path through tough, fibrous weed, and everything was pressure shrunk down here. How can anything live up at the surface? He recalled asking Wu, who was said to have read every book that existed in the Cleopatra Canyon colonies, most of them two or three times. Did not the founders say the sky was thick with poison?
With carbon dioxide and sulfuric acid, yes. I have shown you how we use pinyon leaves to separate out those two substances, both of which have uses in the workshop. One we exhale, and the other burns, yet in small amounts it smells sweet. That is because the founders, in their wisdom, put symbionts in our blood. Creatures that help us deal with pressure and gases that would kill folks who still live on enslaved Earth.
Jonah didn't like to envision tiny animals coursing through his body, even if they did him good. Each year, a dozen kids throughout the bubble colonies were chosen to study such useful things, biological things. A smaller number chose the field that interested Jonah, where even fewer were allowed to specialize. But the blood creatures can only help us down here, where the pinions supply us with breathable air, not up top, where poisons are so thick. Jonah gestured skyward. Is that why none of the risers have ever returned? Once every year or two, the canyon colonies lost a person to the hell that awaited above, most often because of a buoyancy accident, a broken tether or boot ballast sent some hapless soul plummeting upward. Another common cause was suicide. And, more rarely, it happened for another reason, one the mothers commanded that no one might discuss or even mention. A forbidden reason. Only now, after the sudden rise of Bezo Bubble and 1,000 human inhabitants, followed by the Aldrin implosion, little else was on anyone's mind.
Even if you survive the rapid change in pressure, one breath up there and your lungs would be scorched as if by flame. Old scholar Wu had answered yesterday. That is why the founders seeded living creatures a bit higher than us, but beneath the protective thermocline layer that keeps most of the poison out of our abyss.
The old man paused, fondling a strange multi-jawed skeleton.
It seems that life, some kind of life, has found a way to flourish near that barrier. So much so that I have begun to wonder.
A sharp voice roused him. Jonah! This time it was Enoch, reminding him to concentrate on work. A good reason to work in pairs. He got busy with the rake. Mother was pregnant again, along with Aunts Leor and Sosun. It always made them cranky with tension as the fetuses took their time deciding whether to go or stay, and if they stayed, whether to come out healthy or as warped ruins. No, it would not do to return from this salvage outing with only half a load. So he and Enoch forged farther afield, hauling the sledge to another spot where high ocean currents often dumped interesting things after colliding with the canyon walls. The algae ponds and pinyons needed fresh supplies of organic matter, especially in recent decades after the old volcanic vents dried up. The Book of Exile says we came down here to use the vents, way back when the sea was hot and new. A shallow refuge for free humans to hide from the Koss, while comets fell in regular rhythm, thumping Venus to life, drowning her fever and stirring her veins. Jonah had only a vague notion what comets were. Great balls drifting through vast emptiness, till godlike beings with magical powers flung them down upon this planet. Balls of ice, like the pale blue slush that formed on the cool downstream sides of boulders in a fast underwater current, about as big as Cleopatra Canyon was wide. That's what books said about a comet. Jonah gazed at the towering cliff walls, enclosing all the world he ever knew. Comets were so vast. Yet they had been striking Venus daily since centuries before colonists came, immense pre-creation icebergs pelting the sister world of old Earth. Perhaps several million of them by now, herded first by human civilization and later by Koss masters, who adopted the project as their own, one so ambitious as to be nearly inconceivable. So much ice, so much water. Building higher and higher till it has to fill the sky, even the poison skies of Venus, so much that it fills all of creation. Jonah, watch out! Enoch's shouted warning made him crouch and spin about, or Jonah tried to, in the clumsy coveralls, raising clouds of muck stirred by heavy, shuffling boots. What? What is it? Above you, heads up! Tilting back was strenuous, especially in a hurry. The foggy faceplate didn't help. Only now Jonah glimpsed something overhead, shadowy and huge, looming fast out of the black. Run! He required no urging. Heart pounding in terror, Jonah pumped his legs for all they were worth, barely lifting weighted shoes to shuffle skip with long strides toward the nearby canyon wall, sensing and then back-glimpsing a massive, sinuous shape that plummeted toward him out of the abyssal sky. By dim light from a distant habitat dome, the monstrous shape turned languidly, following his dash for safety, swooping in to close the distance fast. Over his right shoulder, Jonah glimpsed a gaping mouth and rows of huge, glistening teeth, a sinuous body from some nightmare. I'm not going to make it. The canyon wall was just too far. Jonah skidded to a stop, raising plumes of bottom muck. Swiveling into a crouch and half moaning with fear, he lifted his only weapon, a rake meant for gathering organic junk from the seafloor. He brandished it crosswise, hoping to stymie the wide jaw that now careened out of dimness, framed by four glistening eyes. Like some ancient storybook dragon stooping for prey. No protection, the rake was more a gesture of defiance. Come on, monster. A decent plan on the spur of the moment. It didn't work. It didn't have to. The rake shattered along with several ivory teeth as the giant maw plunged around Jonah, crashing into the surrounding mud, trapping him, but never closing, nor biting or chewing. Having braced for all those things, he stood there in a tense hunker as tremors shook the canyon bottom, closer and more spread out than the daily thump. It had to be more of the sinuous monster colliding with surrounding muck, a long, long leviathan. A final ground quiver, then silence. Some creakings, then more silence. And darkness. Enveloped, surrounded by the Titan's mouth, Jonah at first saw nothing. Then, a few faint glimmers. Pinion light from nearby Monsat bubble habitat, streaming in through holes. Holes? In the gigantic head. Holes that gradually opened wider as ocean bottom pressure wreaked havoc on flesh meant for much higher waters. Then the smell hit Jonah. An odor of death. Of course. Such a creature would never dive this deep of its own accord. Instead of being pursued by a ravenous monster, Jonah must have run along the same downdraft conveying a corpse to its grave, an intersection and collision that might seem hilarious someday when he told the story as an old grandpa, assuming his luck held. Right now, he felt sore, bruised, angry, embarrassed, and concerned about the vanishing supply in his meager air bubble. With his belt knife, Jonah began probing and cutting a path out of the trap. He had another reason to hurry. If he had to be rescued by others, there would be no claiming this flesh for Tyree, for his clan and family, for his dowry and husband price. Concerned clicks told him Enoch was nearby, and one promising gap in the monster's cheek suddenly gave way to the handle of a rake. Soon they both were tearing at it, sawing tough membranes, tossing aside clots of shriveling muscle and skin. His bubble helmet might keep out the salt sea, but pungent aromas were another matter. Finally, with Enoch tugging helpfully on one arm, Jonah squeezed out and stumbled several steps before falling to his knees, coughing. "Here come others," said his friend, and Jonah lifted his gaze, spying men in bottom suits and helmets, hurrying this way, brandishing glow bulbs and makeshift weapons. Behind them, he glimpsed one of the cargo subs, a string of mid-sized bubbles pushed by hand-crank propellers, catching up fast. "Help me get up. On top," he urged Enoch, who bore some of his weight as he stood. Together, they sought a route onto the massive head. There was danger in this moment. Without clear ownership, fighting might break out among salvage crews from different domes, as happened a generation ago over the last hot vent on the floor of Cleopatra Canyon. Only after several dozen men were dead had the grandmothers made peace. But if Tyree held a firm claim to this corpse, then rules of gift generosity would parcel out shares to every dome, with only a largest best allotment to Tyree. Peace and honor now depended on his speed, but the monster's cranium was steep, crumbly, and slick. Frustrated and almost out of time, Jonah decided to take a chance. He slashed at the ropey cables binding his soft overalls to the weighted clogs that kept him firmly on the ocean bottom. Suddenly buoyant, he began to sense the fell tug, the pull toward heaven, toward doom. The same tug that had yanked Bezo Colony a few days ago, sending that bubble habitat and all of its inhabitants plummeting skyward. Enoch understood the gamble. Gripping Jonah's arm, he stuffed his rake and knife and hatchet into Jonah's belt. Anything convenient. So far, so good. The net force seemed to be slightly downward. Jonah nodded at his friend and jumped.